All right, can you hear me now? Hello, good Tims for all. Hello, Dreams Child. Nice to see you guys. Hope it's been a wonderful day for you as well. That's lovely. And do I have another way to send monetary support? Absolutely. So you could, by the way, I have now applied for monetization. So then we are actually good to go for that in probably a day or so. That's excellent. Thank you for letting me know. And yeah, if anybody is wanting to send support, then you could use my email address at PayPal. I'll spell it for you, MERPRENEUR. That spells merpreneur. I made that word up. And that's at bethmartins.com. So thank you, Dreams Child. I appreciate you asking for that. And I'm looking forward to having that next little level here at my channel. Thanks to Rose777 who actually made it happen. So we're just waiting now to welcome Mr. Jordan Foltz. He's having a couple of issues, he says, so that's all fine. And yeah, I'm super excited about this. I had a chance to meet Mr. Jordan Foltz through, I believe it was Steve Mercer. So Steve Mercer, I don't know if you're here today. I would love to have you here today. I'm gonna maybe share the link. Dixie, are you by any chance able to message to Steve and get him this link, just in case for some reason he didn't see my email? And then I don't know if you're knowing Steve or you have his message. Let me see. I'm going to do it. So bear with me and thank you for your patience. I appreciate that very much. So I'm going to tell Steve myself. Oh, fuck. How do you like that for bad language? Bear with me. I'm just adding this. All right, I'm back. Does anybody want to take a deep breath with me? I think that's what I need right now. And I'm just sending one message to Steve. Here we go. And if you feel like sharing this, then please do. And yes, your friends. Okay, I already sent him the link, but thanks anyway. Sorry, I apologize. I asked you and I did it. That's not great delegating right there. Hello, Voynich. Nice to see you. Voynich, I pulled up a video the other day just to find out what Voynich means. I see that it's a code of some kind, so I'm getting closer to knowing and seeing what's going on here. And yeah, so if we're going to talk today about the essential nature of beauty and the tyranny of the anesthetic aesthetic. I literally just used that title from one of Jordan's videos because it was just so captivating. And it's also perfect timing because we are going to be looking at, not this Friday, but the Friday after, we're going to be doing an archetype study group on the lover archetype. And this is the script of the lover that Jordan doesn't know yet. So we'll keep it a secret until he's here. I mean, when he's here. And so I'm going to definitely need to find out. Oh, I think we've got takeoff here. Hello to Jordan. I'm going to add you to the stream. We are already live, just so you know.
Okay. How are you?
Hello, Jordan.
Hey, how are you?
Hi. Really good. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, good to meet you too. Sorry about that. It took me, I should have troubleshooted that a little bit before. But yeah, just some issues recognizing the camera and the microphone or something like that. So.
Right. 20 minutes notice wasn't, or pardon me, 20 seconds notice wasn't enough for you.
25 is what I mean. Yeah, I should have communicated that prior.
Yeah, I'm pretty last second person over here. I usually make it exactly on time. That's my thing. So, well, I will just take a minute to introduce. This is the King Hero's Journey podcast. For those of you that may not have been here before to check one of these out. I am here with a very special guest, Jordan Foltz, Poppy Aesthesia. And before I send it over to him to introduce himself, I will let you know that I am Beth Martins. I am a business archetype and purpose coach who helps people to turn their life's work into businesses, who sometimes helps them to just simply discover what they are here on this earth to do at this time in, of their life, to slay the demons and dragons on the hero's journey, and to find out, you know, how do they fit in with this humanity that has so many different angles and perspectives, and especially, you know, the image that we're given of humanity. There's every extreme. Personally, I have enormous faith in humanity. I love human beings. And I think if you give them a chance to do good and be good, they will. And then there's a lot of evidence also we're seeing for, you know, psychopathic leadership and the populations going crazy and burning buildings down. But I see through a lot of that stuff. I've been following for 3 years, which isn't very long, actually, the truth movement, and feeling and enjoying its momentum so much. So, Jordan, thank you. I love your work. I love what you're up to.
Thank you, Beth. So my name is Jordan Foltz. Poppy Aesthesia is the name of my YouTube channel, which is a small channel. I originally started it. In 2018 with a walk away video from the Democratic Party. And I had gotten tuned into the walk away movement. And I was like, you know, I'm feeling all of these incongruities that these people are expressing here, and so much frustration with what politicians are saying and what they're representing, that I need to post a walk away video and some of my thoughts there. But it's really butted into much more of a deeper dive into how I my thought streams and how I see the world, and deeper archetypal trends that I see not only in the world, but that I see on the individual psyche. And it's kind of just an amalgamation of monologues, I guess, that I record up in my tobacco barn. I'm fortunate enough to have a old not dilapidated enough to be falling down, but it's getting there. Tobacco barn. I'm in the mountains of North Carolina, and it's kind of a beautiful little space up there on the edge of the meadow. And I go up there and speak toward trends that I'm seeing and the deeper motivations or maps that I think are governing some of the things that are going on, or motivators of people. Some insights that I have also about what we can be paying attention to as individuals to not fall victim to narratives or traps that I think lead us to things like enslavement and lack of freedom and dependency and infantile type realities, which I think there's a large seduction in today's world toward those very things, particularly in like infantilism and dependency. I worked for 4 years, and I still work with these boys. I'm no longer the director of the organization, but I was the director for 4 years of an organization that was offering rites of passage and mentoring to teenage boys, in particular here in our community. And actually, boys came from around the Southeast to attend these rites of passage that we put on. And so I've been heavily invested with, you know, boots on the ground and sweat equity in the actual, sounds like you're invested too, you know, beyond just the narrative, beyond just speaking to it, beyond just being another mouthpiece, which I feel an obligation and a responsibility to be that too, to throw my hat in the ring of the narrative. But I am also very invested in having boots on the ground and, you know, physical, real, charismatic relationships with humans, you know, particularly adolescent boys in my case, to help to invite them into, you know, deeper ways of living their lives and connect them to some of the archetypal realities and masculine archetypes in particular that have served my ancestors and their ancestors for a long time. And gotten us to where we are, allowed us to survive as a species, and not just survive, but survive in epic ways and live with purpose. So I'm no longer doing that work in a paid capacity anymore, but I still facilitate the rites of passage and mentor these boys while it's been on hiatus for about 3 months because, you know, regulations and things like that for social distancing, the program's kind of been shut down. But yeah, I live on a small homestead here in Western North Carolina. I've got 3 daughters and a lovely wife, and we grow food as we can. And, we try to live a good life and apply ourselves to also constantly be uncovering truth and living according to what I would consider divine law.
Beautiful. Sorry, I was muted there. It's such a perfect fit. Thanks to Steve Mercer for introducing us, because, you know, just every little bit of the work that I've consumed so far at your channel has really landed. And then as I was getting ready, knowing this was coming up, I went to your latest, and it's just speaking the script, and the timing was perfect of the lover archetype, which I would want to go into deeper, but I would actually want to ask you some questions first, just about your life. You've said what inspired you to get into this in the first place. And how do you manage the responsibility? So, you know, the king hero's life typically has many moving parts. You are, as you said, you know, you don't want to just be the mouthpiece of the narrative, the good, even though it's the good one, or, you know, a helpful one. You know, typically the king heroes take on a lot of responsibility. This series was actually inspired by my father's passing away in part, and working intensely with that masculine archetype as a result. You know, I didn't know I had been fighting with that my whole life, but all of a sudden there I was with the war was very clearly not about me and anybody in my life. It was an internal battle. And I came out the other side with such a different perspective on men in general. All of my, you know, I felt like I had invented the feminist movement my whole life, that I was rah-rah, hoping women would take over the world, and anything wrong with the world was a man's problem, or, you know, caused by men. And so now on the other side of it, I just have a completely different perspective and openness, and certainly appreciation for the amount of stress and pressure that men go through to, you know, keep home and family together and raise children, and plus get out there into the field and do the work that needs to be done. So how do you manage the stress of it?
Well, lately, not very well, honestly, Beth. It's getting pretty heavy out there, and I have stress. And I have anxiety, and that's just, you know, that comes with the territory, I think, of pulling your head out of the sand, regardless of whether one is a king hero masculine archetype or a feminine archetype of some kind. I think, you know, taking the responsibility and having the courage to pull one's head out of the sand and no longer just accept what is being handed or fed. And choosing to go hunt or grow one's own food, so to speak, metaphorical psychic food, brings with it a level of exposure of the numinous, of just how vulnerable I am, how vulnerable we are. But at the same time, it has brought with it a deepening faith in the divine. As I extricate myself more from the artificial, contrived, and I think fallacious narratives and laws or foundations that I think many people are trying to create for humanity today, I find myself having to lean more and more and find stability more and more in things that I think are immutable, things that I would consider divine laws that are consistent through nature. Patterns and relationships, and the way that life relates to itself, and the way that families relate to themselves, and the way that things grow, and the way that, you know, things compete and help each other grow, and systems of symbiosis and things like that. I look to those for information on how I should live my life. And I find my faith in those things. So yeah, it's a double-edged sword, pulling my head out of the sand and being exposed to certainly social criticism, certainly, I expose myself. The things that I talk about on my channel, I think, are are far more fundamental and foundational than some kind of like superficial social or political commentary, but they definitely go to those places. And they're not popular, at least they might be popular in sheer numbers, but they're not popular as far as the surface level of the zeitgeist right now. You know, the positions that I take, like personal responsibility, or equating empowerment with responsibility, or freedom with responsibility, or purpose with exposure and the experience of pleasure and pain, or, the necessity for living dangerously to some extent to find one's purpose and to be able to bear adversity. These things are not common narratives in the zeitgeist, and people are very trained to kind of shout it down. So there's some social vulnerability that I definitely expose myself to. So all that aside, yeah, go for it.
Quickly ask you a question. So how do you manage when people attack you? What do you do with that? How do you field that?
Well, you know, to be honest, I haven't promoted my channel in my local community, but I've been pretty, here's how I do it. So when my YouTube channel is one thing, and me and my community is kind of a different thing. I'm a little less outspoken. Well, I'm a little less confrontational, let's say, in person. And so I'm seeking to build friendships. I'm seeking to build alliances. I'm seeking to build community and do things in a good way here with the boots on the ground. And so I don't think that it's important or it's probably not productive for me to be confrontational when it comes to like doing a local interview or speaking on behalf of an organization or speaking about rites of passage with a local newspaper or paper or something like that, or a local radio show with somebody who may disagree with me about some of these, more fundamental truths about responsibility or masculinity. I try to find common ground with them, and I accept their perspectives when they voice them that are very often contrary to my own, like particularly the one having to do with, say, toxic masculinity or the idea of making men more feminine as being a good thing versus, connecting men more with their masculinity. So I seek to address people respectfully. I seek to maintain a fabric of respect in a relationship. And I try and I speak to what I see as true with as much circumspection and intelligence and with founded principles and consistency as I can, and with compassion and coming from a place of compassion and love rather than confrontation and anger or trying to rip anybody down. Now, that's not always the energy that somebody gets when they watch my videos on YouTube. That's more of like me letting it out up in the tobacco barn, you know, rather than having a conversation with somebody who doesn't agree with me. And when the criticism comes, let's say the criticism comes through social media or something like that, I'll invite somebody to a cup of tea. I never get into a debate on Facebook or in the comments section of anything. Mm-hmm. I just don't do it. I used to, and it's just, it can go on forever. Somebody does, 300 words there. Somebody who does 500 words there and counterpoints, and it's not helpful. So I stop doing that, and I'll just say, okay, well, let's explore these ideas together and go out to tea sometime. Mm-hmm. And a couple of people have taken me up on it. I seek to preserve friendships rather than burn bridges. Mm-hmm. I never insult anybody. And that's what I seek to do is not get sucked into the fight or flight defense mode when being shouted down, so to speak, but try to find the rational or the principles. I really try to suss out somebody's principles. Like, where are you coming from with your anger toward me? Or what is the threat that I'm posing to you? What exactly that I'm saying do you disagree with? Let's find out what that is and then discover if there is any difference at all. Most often people are not willing to go that deep. But a couple people have gone to tea with me. So, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Just trying to open this and give somebody, that's amazing. Again, you and I are on a very similar track like that. Although I think I have probably left more bodies in the dust, and we're doing another video on Friday about that with Ollie Demigard. Sometimes it's literally cut bait and run. because you can't, you know, they're not going to stop attacking for some reason.
Yeah.
And so there's been a lot of block, delete, block, delete, block, delete. But I will always do that exact thing. I will say, because they'll come in with an attack and I'll say like, hey, Catherine, so nice to hear from you. I haven't talked to you for a long time. And, you know, just like, remember we were connected as people before there was an issue between us. And would you like to jump on a call? Would you like to talk? Would you like to hear each other's voice? And they're almost always turning it down. No, thank you. Because I think they're knowing somewhere that they're going to have a connection and they're going to see past it. Same with family. There's been a lot of family attacks and I go the same route. I can't just block and cut bait and run with family, of course. So you just can't do that. So I'll attempt to just have a conversation about something entirely not that they were attacking me about. And better to preserve. It's a really good way to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Things can get burned. And I'm human. Obviously we are all human, right? I mean, maybe not all of us, but I think we are probably. I don't have any proof, but I go on that presumption. And so I know that I too can default into a place where I'm operating or speaking from a place of preserving my self-righteousness and trying to assert how I'm right and prevent myself from being proven wrong. So it's like, it's hard for me to, I'm not perfect. I'm not always completely aware of what my motivating factors are. I try to ground them in principles and truth and foundations, you know, and truths that I hold dear. However, I know that I am also, you know, mammalian to some extent, and I will operate out of a place of trying to preserve my self-righteousness too. And so just trying to keep tabs on myself. It's like the dragon, like you said, the constant cycles of the hero's journey within myself, and every interaction and every conversation every day is its own mini hero's journey where I'm navigating, you know, the adventure and the truth and what dragons deep within myself I'm going to confront and slay and bring back into the light, you mm-hmm. know? So mm-hmm. I guess it's mm-hmm. the willingness to do that. That's important.
That's beautiful. Beautiful. What makes it worth it for you? I'd love to ask this question of the King Heroes. So going through the hardship, whether it's at that personal level or your community or attacks, what makes it worth it on the other side for you?
I think that it's about having a soul that's intact. I do not believe that it's possible to compromise one's morals, ethics, or moral compass and keep one's soul from getting some serious damage. And I believe that once, if I were to start to go down that path, as soon as I answer the call, to compromising my moral compass or what I know to be true in order to attain, say, social favor or status points on the social scale versus what I would consider more the eternal, personal, divine scale. And it's not about like credits with the divine. It's not some transactional thing. It's just trying to find congruity with what I see to be the structure of reality. And the payoff is that I my soul stays intact. I sleep well at night as far as what I'm doing, how I'm applying myself and my actions. I have purpose. I know how to answer questions that my children have. I know how to raise them and feel good about how I'm raising them. And I believe that when someone starts to go down the alternate path, which I think is a dark path, and it's one that I think can largely be characterized by equating morality or ethics with social status. So seeking one's moral consummation through social approval, that leads to mob type outcomes usually. And even if an actual mob doesn't take place, compromising even the path or the strife to be aligned with one's true morals, or say with some like foundational true path, I think creates misery. I really think that you can't, I'm not jealous of people who say have better, more status or wealth or fame or anything like that. If it seems like it was achieved through compromising those parts of themselves, if that makes sense, because I do think it leads to unhappiness and some severe anxiety and misery. So the payoff, I think that's what your question was, or what makes it worth it, is working for truth. Yeah. And not, I mean, I think if I were not to, then I would have some severe, like far more deep levels, bigger worries, bigger levels of anxiety, and I'd be lost. Mm-hmm. Be lost in the world. It's like, I don't know if you saw, if you watched the Game of Thrones or anything like that, but like, there's this great piece in it where there's this young man who's been raised by the Stark family, and the Stark's kind of like the really heroic family of the series. And they've taken him in as a son, and they've treated him as a son, and he has all this responsibility. And then he gets this idea that if he betrays them and throws him under the bus, he can achieve his true kinghood. If he turns his back on that which has nurtured him, fed him, if he turns his back on essentially like his morals, his morality, and his commitments, and his real family for his own building up his own stature, for social approval and status, then he'll achieve something worthwhile. And he's at this point where he turns on the family that raised him, and he's about to kill one of the key members. And that key member looks up at him, and he's this religious man, he's this monk, and he just shakes his head and he says, "Theon, now you're truly lost." And he looks in the eyes, and Theon kills him. But the last thing the monk saw was like, "You're in the black hole, man. You're mm-hmm. gone. Mm-hmm. You're gonna take my life, but you're the one that's gone." And that's so true. So that's kind of like a little story that I think answers the question. That's what makes it worth it to me. I'd rather be the monk. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Wow, that's so powerful. I absolutely love your answer to that question. So good. I just had a comment come up in the chat here. Flatplane Oregon said, "Lovers of the lies are the most difficult people to associate with. And it's not easy for humanitarian altruists like myself." And I mean, as your story illustrates, you're literally putting your life on the line for these things, because, you know, it's not the common person, even if there's people, and they've come out of the woodwork now, right? In the last 8-9 weeks, whatever it's been, those that were edging towards the truth have come out more with that, or they might have gone the other direction. They might have gone more into the closet, more yeah. into fear. But there is a cost. There absolutely is a cost. It's, you know, it's a daily cost. So I go into the grocery store. I've already weeped and cried about this on my channel, so I won't go into too much detail. But I got shamed in a grocery store because I broke the rules, and I did it very on purpose just so I could have a discussion and make a scene. I just made a scene. And, you know, so the alternative was just to go into that store, put my head down, follow the stupid arrows or whatever is going on there, and then leave. But then I'm out of integrity with myself, literally, mm-hmm. you know, yep. for not making trouble. And now I can so relate to my great-grandfather, who was arrested in Russia for antagonizing the government during mm-hmm. the Russian Revolution in 1911, right? Like, where do you have to get to where you're actually actively causing trouble for yourself, going to jail?
Yeah.
Right. But the alternative is what you said. It's a much deeper, bigger hell that yeah. you're not right with your own soul and with God. So I would rather be in that place any day.
Yes. Yeah. I agree. Well, I'm curious, you know, cause for me, like this, and I'm always cautious. I don't want to not paint myself as like some kind of a moral, icon or something like that. I'm not, but
for sure.
but I care, and I've never not cared. And I trace it back to, I mean, I remember we make the shift from childhood to the adult world, and the shift naturally starts happening in the adolescent years, but there needs to be interventions there to make it happen in a good way, in a powerful way, regardless of whether the interventions happen rites of passage or direct instruction or some sort of process toward becoming a man or a woman happens, there's natural things that start to happen within oneself where things start to shift socially. The social fabric shifts. There's nobody out there who's gone through 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, male or female, who hasn't, I think, been betrayed by a close friend because somebody sold them off for social points or something like that, or started to see people act differently to achieve social points or blend in. Mm-hmm. And the decisions I think that one starts to make at that point in their lives are very foundational for how they're going to act later in life. So do you join the mob then? Do you sell out? Do you bully Jimmy and call them names because the other guys are doing it? Do you call the women bitches and hoes because the other guys are doing it? Or do you say, this is kind of gross, and not do it and do something else? You know, or take your example. There's a million examples you can have depending on the culture or the time. For me, it was like those two. It was kind of this mob mentality that came about where, you know, the ugly side of the boys was showing itself, you know. And I've done a lot more research on it now and thinking into it. And it's like, well, they've worked, I think a lot of those guys have worked through it, and maybe it was just part of the process. But I will say that at the time that those things were happening in my friend groups, I didn't go there. I didn't associate with it. And it felt like the first crossroads in my life where I had a choice of preserving my integrity and my soul or going and calling my friends, I don't even want to say the words, you know, on your show, but like ugly words behind their back in this group kind of way. Mm-hmm. And so at the time it kind of sucked because in high school I was a bit of an outcast because of that. And I wasn't as cool as I could have been. And people called names behind my back, but it set me up to have the resilience to deal with that same sort of that same sort of attitude and willingness to stand in an exposed way for the rest of my life.
Brilliant.
So, you know, it's baby steps. I think people get slowly, it's so trite at this point and overused, but it's useful to go to Nazi Germany example. It's like the people who were complicit didn't just jump into being guards of a damn gas chamber overnight. It was agreeing to lies bit by bit by bit. Oh, this isn't so bad. Well, that's not so far of a step from this. Well, that's not so far of a step to this, all the way until you're standing at the gates of Auschwitz. And I think that every choice is a choice of freedom or confinement in that way. Yeah.
Boom. I love that. Every choice is a choice of freedom or confinement. Because that's what people are yelling at me about. Like, you know, standing in line at the grocery store isn't an affront to your freedom, Beth. This isn't about your freedom. It's like, no, you don't understand. This is exactly what you said, those incremental agreements that you make all my life. Now I've lived long enough to see how there's just been one after the other. And when they take away, they don't give back, right? 9/11 was another big major timing for that.
Yep.
I shouldn't say those words, but we'll see if I can get away with it. So then, so many things. Do you want to talk about rite of passage, since that's a big part of your work, and why that's, you know, I have a background in anthropology. Originally, I did a degree, and rites of passage was a major study for me, looking at that and how it really seems like we lack that. Do you think that's something that in society we've lost the art of putting people through those rites of passage?
Yeah, well, yeah, without question, we've lost that art. And I was doing an interview with somebody a couple weeks ago, and she asked me, do you have a vision for bringing that back? And I think that's the first time somebody had asked me that question. And I was sad to say that I did not. And I'm somebody who actually orchestrates and facilitates rites of passage for boys, but it's not what it was. You've read about it. If you studied it in anthropology, I mean, the rites of passage were parts of, it's like a river, you know. It's like if a culture and a people are the water and the flow of a river, the rites of passage was just it was like a rapid that the particles of water went down in order to get to the wider part of the river. It was that would churn them up and make them ready. It was an intense experience that would initiate and almost alchemically kind of change boys. what we do in the program that I work with, it's almost like we create a little side channel and a little pond over here where they go over here and then they re-enter the river. It's not congruent and it's not part of the flow of the actual river. We it's a program they sign up for. It's a program we enroll them into, and then we send them back into their family systems, some of which understand the intensity or the purpose of what they've just been through. Some of them don't. Some of them treat the boys a little differently. Most of them don't. When, you know, boys were initiated, traditionally speaking, they would be taken against their will in the night by men of the community, and they would not come back until they had done what there was to do. And if that was killing an antelope with your bare hands, that was killing an antelope with your bare hands. And if you didn't do it, you weren't going to be a man. So you could come back, but you'd be treated as a boy the rest of your life. The stakes were very high, and it would take them weeks and weeks and weeks to come back, and they would have to endure very intense rituals and challenges in order to come back. What we offer is a three-day thing. They know exactly when they're coming back. Their parents know exactly when they're coming back. And that's the society that we live in. In order to truly bring somebody through a rites of passage, the level of danger or perceived danger, it's not that you actually have to hang them over a literal pit of alligators, but the perception of the person going through the experience must be life or death. And this is both spiritual and physical life of death. The perception must be, if I do not look within and find my inner resources and figure out how to deal with this situation before me, which is very dangerous and very exposed, then I'm not going to make it out of this. And through putting people through that experience, boys through that experience, they were one, confronted with very deep-seated fears that they had, and they were forced to confront that dragon parts of themselves. When we're put in a place where we're very afraid for our lives, very often that's where we start to turn on each other. Like, I don't know if you've ever been lost with somebody in a car, and it's like you're lost and you don't know where you are, and it's like, you didn't read the map right. And it's like, well, you didn't read north on the thing. And it's just like people start to get mad and start to turn at each other. So like putting the boys in the boiler of like that place turned up a thousandfold, made them face their own inner demons that would, the impulses in themselves that would turn on somebody, that would blame somebody else, that would be destructive to others or their community, and have to see that for what it was and integrate it into themselves and bring it back up into the light with them. And the other part is that it would, well, there's a couple other parts, but they would be forced to find the strength and inner resources that it took to rise to the occasion and meet it, so that when they came back, they didn't shrink from adversity or seek to be sheltered from adversity of the everyday world and everyday life. They were like, I had to hang from a tree without water for a week in the wind and almost fell out. If I would have fallen, I would have died. Like I can now go off and do X, well, I can go hunting next week. It's not a big deal. Oh, I got in an argument with my wife. Not such a big deal. Oh, you know, like there's a fire. We have to move our village or whatever it is. They could confront. It was designed to help them confront everyday challenges and adversities that come with being born into a physical body in a good way, in a strong way, in a courageous way. It's very hard to think about what it would take to bring those back today. And I don't think that rites of passage per se in their original form are necessary to inculcate or nurture or build those kinds of qualities in people. But more intentional processes and raising and rearing of children to integrate them specifically with adversity, danger, and some level of pain, whether that's emotion or physical, is a good thing. And I know that sounds crazy in today's culture. I say that in today's culture, people are like, you're crazy. That's abusive. Protect them. Protect, protect, protect. Shelter, shelter, shelter. You want to do that, you're going to get kids who run screaming from somebody who disagrees with them. And that's what we have today, you know?
You got it. We're on the same page with that. A great comment just came from the well-read poet. Oh, I love your name, by the way. I just, when I said it out loud, now I get it. So he thinks, and this is exactly what I was going to ask you, Jordan, is do you think that this is a massive rite of passage that we're in, right? It's putting such pressure on humanity, and it's tempting to think true colors coming out, but it's really, it's what we these humans look like under such poor conditions, even though it's not really as poor as it's going to be. That's for sure. So do you think we're in this major rite of passage right now?
I hope so. I hope so. And again, you know, in every rites of passage, not everybody came back.
Exactly. That's the thing. It's not a guarantee that you get through it. It is an ordeal for a reason. They don't call it the hero's journey for nothing.
Yep. So some people came back. And I speak from the male perspective. I'm not familiar with female rites of passage. By my understanding, mm-hmm. it didn't exist as much. And, you know, you can name your reasons for that. I think men take more work, honestly, to become men. More, it takes more sculpting. I think there's just certain things that happen that make it a little bit more of a guarantee that women become women. But anyway, we can go there or not. But so certain men came back men. Certain didn't complete the tasks but survived, and they came back boys. And they mm-hmm. had to live in their society, unable to marry, and they were kind of spurned and rejected. You know, they weren't respected, and they were boys. And then some died. You know, it's to me like. Whether this is a rite of passage, and I think it's how somebody treats it as to whether or not they're going to get the benefits and emboldening kind of the emboldening effects from it. Again, uninitiated people who are confronted with adversity run to mommy and daddy, and in situations like these, what very many people are trained to do is run to the government and actually inflame authoritarianism because they're afraid of dealing with things themselves. And so that's a very big danger today, which is happening and poses the potential of really sapping a lot of spiritual and self-actualization benefits that could come from something like this. So I think for people that don't necessarily have that reflex, it will be a rite of passage and we'll get stronger from it. However, en masse and collectively speaking, I think that the intention in part, and I think that the result unfortunately will be to ingratiate paternal and maternal, the dark authoritarian, the consuming devouring mother, and the patriarchal tyrant, you know, in the forms of government tyranny. And I think that people are doing that pretty willingly without seeing exactly what they're doing, but it's coming from an infantile place, in my opinion. So if it's intense enough, you know, and things continue to crumble, I mean, good Lord, what's it going to be next, right? So it's like COVID, mandatory shutdown of everything, riot, cities burning. There's like armed groups of people occupying like a whole sector of Seattle right now. Mayors right and left are saying, you're in the right, we're in the wrong. So if things crumble, if like say authoritarian if it got to the point where authoritarian structures crumbled, then yeah, it would be a guaranteed rite of passage. That would be my main thing that would get in the way of it, would be people's turn toward totalitarianism. But if it goes so far as even those possibilities crumble and it's more of a say anarchic type outcome, then I don't think there's definitely will be a rite of passage for people. And I think future generations will be more initiated and stronger from it. I'm not saying I'm hoping for that. I don't want that to happen, but mm-hmm. it seems like that could be a potential positive outcome from something like that.
Mm-hmm. It seems pretty inevitable to me. I think the fall has already happened and now we're just seeing it play out. You know, the food chain is broken. We're seeing a shadow of food in the grocery stores. The bullet to the economic life has been shot. It's the deed is done. It might still be a 2-year process to see it all play out, but or at least that's for the experts I'm following. That's what they're saying. I shouldn't be so sure of myself about that. But one thing not to skip past too quick also is do you think this is something that, as I was writing my book, which is based on the hero's journey, I was rereading The Hero with a Thousand Faces, and I had read it back in my anthropology days, and I got halfway through it and I'm like, done. I'm actually not going to read that book again because it's so gory. And I remember that about my education, that there, you know, you're learning about so many things around the world. And I'm not exactly judging, but I'm wondering if the whole process of rite of passage has been hijacked like so many other things have. And that, yes, of course, you want to put a child under a certain amount of stress and, you know, make them do the thing that's going to transform them from the boy to the man. But when it comes to like severe trauma, enacting trauma, now I know it's like when you have to face your own demons, you have to find your resourcefulness. If if you're hanging from that tree and you might die, and you've got to find the way to be in balance and not go insane in the process, that's all good. And I'm glad for you that you did that. Just thinking of Benjamin Balderson, who spent a bunch of time in total isolation in jail, and it was torture for him, right? Some people will go insane. He went insane and came back and went insane and came back. And, you know, so that was good and fortunate. But do you think there is a point where it's just become they're breaking up the boy and the mother completely? You know, I tested this theory with my son, and I gave him just 100% unconditional presence and answered his every call for 2.5 years. And everybody said, oh man, you are going to make that child dependent on you. He's going to be, you know, he won't be a real man, all this kind of rhetoric. And he flipped, and whether I had anything to do with it or not, I don't totally know, but he flipped and became this incredibly independent, secure, never once cried when I dropped him off somewhere, doesn't need me. I'm the one always just initiating that we have a connection, like so independent. I can't believe it. Really secure in himself. So anyway, I'm talking a lot. What do you think of that?
When was that devotion period that you spoke of?
The devotion, like when I was just totally answering all his calls.
Yeah.
It was like birth to about 2.5 years old.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, I don't think those are the years to instigate. And I'm not a child psychologist by any means, and well, whatever. But not that I would turn to them per se for the best answers for everything either. But my take on it is that wouldn't be any kind of years to start initiating separation from the mother. But it's about the teenage years. And I think that the impulse is natural to individuate from one's parents in the teenage years. It's almost universal. I mean, not every kid has that come up, but most of them do. Your parents start to suck when you're a teenager, regardless of how great they actually are. You have to individuate yourself. If they're on the left, you go right. If they say this, you say that, blah, 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 you know? Now to have directionless rebellion, it needs some guidance, and I think that's part of where rites of passage come in. So rather than relying on the parents to determine your path, you got like taking them away from the parents so that they're actually relying on the cosmos as a whole to determine their path is a good thing. Mm-hmm. But I'm still exploring I'm still developing opinions and perspectives on this, but I do think that separation, particularly from the mother, is important in the teenage years, and not necessarily, you know, permanent. I don't know how gory it has to be, but it is a very. I don't understand how it could be so cross-culturally, nearly universal, as a necessity to becoming a man, to have that separation from the feminine and from the feminine world, the hospice of the maternal world, and the separation from the mother. I think that's just very compelling to me that it's nearly universal. And you might know some examples that are exceptions, but it's just so common that it, like from Europe to Africa to the Amazon to Papua New Guinea to, you know, that you find these similar themes in the necessity of boys constantly having to temper themselves, particularly against the seduction back into the safe, protected world of the feminine. expressed most purely through the mother itself, that the physical, you know, blood mother. So maybe it doesn't, it doesn't have to happen, I don't think, on a rites of passage level. I think that those are the two, and not every rites of passage were not universal, but this process of extricating boys in particular from the realm of the maternal to bring them into the exposed world of men is darn near universal. And I think when I think deeply about it, I even go beyond anthropology, because I am more of a metaphysical thinker. You know, I've talked about divine law and structures of reality and like what I try to see and live into. And I kind of see the structure of reality. You know, many different cultures throughout time have had a masculine pole and a feminine pole, you know, the yin and the yang, the Prakriti and the Purusha in Ayurveda, or the Holy Father and the Holy Mother. I mean, if you get into Christian Essene Gospels, they speak of the Holy Mother as well as the Holy Father. And, you know, that's also a universal phenomenon. So regardless of male, female, mother, father, those to me are representations of something even more fundamental. And what does it take for the masculine energy or the masculine archetype to exist? I think it takes consistent applied effort, because I think that in some ways, not that one is more fundamental than the other, but I think in some ways, I don't know how to express it. I need to work out my language on this, but I think in some ways the feminine is more fundamental, and that, and the masculine takes constant applied effort to be expressed and actuated, because the impulse and the pull and the seduction is to be reunified with the feminine from whence it came. Which doesn't take effort. It's kind of getting seduced back into the all that is, this kind of inertia place of, you know, solidity and, you know, potential energy unknown. It's the mysterious unknown. And to bring form to things and constantly be shining light on and exposing oneself and taking action is hard. And so, yeah, I do think that becoming a man, let's say, takes constant applied effort. And I think that that masculine energy, to some extent, is similar to that. Whether or not it needs to be some gory separation from the mother and a rites of passage, I wouldn't say that it does. Yeah.
Amazing. So good. I just wanted to highlight this comment from Dixie. She said, women could be diving into compassion and supporting the strength of men. I notice a lot of women who are freaking out right now because the men are not strong enough to protect them. And this is the reason why, right? They have never, they've had that seduction and gone back much into a much more feminine place. It's pretty intense. You know, there's no point in judging. That's not going to bring the best out in a man for sure. But at the same time, it's just so starkly clear. I was visiting with someone the other night, and they're avoiding the media like the plague. So that's like actually good. But instead of getting the narrative straight from the media, they get it badly filtered through Facebook.
Yeah.
So it's the same damn narrative. Yeah. And it's so passive, and it's so, you know, like I'll just have a suntan in my backyard and nothing wrong is happening in my backyard. So yeah. I'm good and I'm relaxed, and I'm not going to even bother having a relationship with a woman because that's so, you know, disturbing to my little bliss bubble that I'm living in here. That's, I don't know. Anyway, I'm judging.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that it's a combination, like what the person who just wrote in described. I think it's a combination of, fashion, like artificial social engineering. Like there's been active effort put into fashioning men in a different way. So
they're wearing dresses on the front of magazines, right? Like,
that's, yeah, so there you go. That's like, that's the most blatant example. So it's been steps like take on more feminine qualities, you know, celebrating things like compassion, sensitivity, speaking about your emotions, the emotion sensitive man, the sensitive type, the brooder, you know, like it's been a celebrated kind of image for many years now, while aggressiveness, competitiveness, assertiveness, you know, entrepreneurial creativity, you know, dominance, those have been poo-pooed and maligned very, very harshly. And starting with the 19, you know, in my opinion, starting, maybe it started before, but it seems to have been kind of kicked off in by 1970s feminism, and then adopted by mainstream culture, which fashioned a new masculinity. And so men, I think, are encouraged to get, again, social status points to be more effeminate, to be slighter in physical build, for one. And I'm nobody to speak toward that. I'm not a particularly built guy, but to be more compassionate, to be more emotional, to say, I feel this, I feel that, rather than I think this, or I think that, or I do this and I do that, which are more masculine types. And so it's been a fashioning as well as kind of a pairing up with the lack of initiation that so it's both, you know, it's lack of initiation and it's just a natural fashion thing. And there's an effort to eliminate both masculinity and femininity and pretend that they're just superstitious tropes from scared, you know, Western patriarchs, rather than something far deeper, which is what I was getting into in the last question. Far deeper, like maybe the structure of reality itself, like maybe the structure of life itself, you know, and those kind of dialogues and narratives are incredibly superstitious and superficial. And those are the ones that are getting promoted in mainstream culture, ones that associate masculinity and femininity just with social constructs of gender. And that's all any of it is. And then we have an obligation to break those things down. And if mm-hmm. we can break down masculinity and femininity on a gender scale, then that proves that they don't exist and never did at all. And therefore we've conquered something. We've liberated ourselves. I don't know. You know, it's just, it's a purposeless, it's a nihilistic inquiry, if you ask me.
Yeah, it's that upside down inversion. They're calling slavery liberation, and you know, yeah. The gender mess. We've all had our kids out of school, as I'm sure you have as well. And so I'm like, yay, right on, no school. That's awesome. Yeah. I hope it goes on and on. And so we get a very sad email saying the protocol of when they come back, what torture they're going to have to go through and the chemicals they're going to have to deal with and staying separate from everybody and all that kind of thing. And then first thing on the program, get this, is gender studies. What? And yeah, school? Yes, in Canada. I was like, it's already a big problem in British Columbia, unfortunately. So it's already got into the country. And their first assignment was to go out and look for examples of the, you know, gender, I don't know if I'm using this word right, but dysphoria, or, you know, the gender lie. So a woman holding a baby and enjoying her home or something like that would be an example of, you know, the abuse of women or the inequality of women in it, you know. And it's just like, what? Where, what, you know?
Amazing.
I know. It's shocking. I could not believe it, actually. And I don't consent. I'm going to jump up and down on my head if I have to. If my kid goes back to that school, I'm going to be a big pain in their ass. And I've already been a pain in their ass. Like, we're breaking your rules. Get over it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
So
yeah.
Pretty well, scary.
It is. That is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's outrageous because it's separating to me what is our biggest natural resource in humanity is the connection of a man and a woman. Mm-hmm. Right? You bring these energies together and all kinds of incredible magic can happen because I've got my side of the thing handled and you've got your side of the thing handled, and together this is nature's design. Right, what birthed the child was in my system is the masculine and the feminine archetype that gave birth to the first phase of the hero's journey, where you individuate and you have the opportunity to move away from the security of the womb or the mother, allow for the betrayal to happen, that must happen so that you take up the fight and go on your way to ultimately be of service to others.
Yes, yeah. They're very isolated little lies and conversations that do not find corroboration when anybody takes a look outside of them. You know, you get a pamphlet, you get your gender studies pamphlet that assigns you that homework that trains you to look at truths as lies. So look at a woman enjoying her time with her baby or something like to consider that. I wear this hat. I don't know if I have it in here, but I wear this hat of the Virgin Mary and the child because it reminds me, I wear it And I'm not necessarily of a particular faith. I'm definitely a theist. But it expresses to me the most fundamental spark of what life is. That maternal child connection is the most foundational thing, the most guaranteed thing that provides us with strength. And to teach them to go and see that as a lie is the biggest waste of, well, it's the biggest lie, but it's also the biggest waste of energy. So why, you know, the old ways would be to try to find fundamental truths that one can take for granted about who we are as humans, like a mother loving her child, right? Or like beauty, right? You mentioned that conversation.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that.
Yeah, or man and woman. Find the most fundamental things and build laws, societies from that. Like you said, now it's an inversion. Now it's find the most fundamental things and destroy them.
Yes.
Right? Rather than let nature work for our own benefit. Mm-hmm. If mothers are naturally going to love their children more than anything, why don't we create systems that take down the barriers of them doing that? Because that's going to create a better society. More mothers loving their children more fully is going to make things better. Rather than you start to convince people that the love of a mother for her child is a lie or something to be worked against, that mm-hmm. is like breaking apart the hydrogen atom. That is like, that's going for the jugular right there.
You got it.
The fabric of everything. Yeah,
you got it. And that was no surprise, unfortunately, very sad, but no surprise when with the COVID stuff, they started recommending mothers, wear a mask with their infant or be separated from their infant right at birth to do all the testing BS first, right? Like they go for that jugular. The war is on the children. Actually, they know if they can kill and desensitize the child at the beginning, then the job is done for the whole life. So it's really incredibly tragic. Mm-hmm. If we move over now to the subject that I promised everybody, we could probably talk for a long time. I have a feeling when I saw the title of your latest video, and I apologize, I didn't even make it all the way to the other side of it, but there are so many good videos on Jordan's channel, by the way, you guys. Hello to everybody who's been coming in the chat. I love seeing your comments and your names come by. It's honestly a beautiful thing to have your presence here and so many good things coming up. But if we dive into this topic, the essential nature of beauty, one of the archetypes that I work with in the hero's journey is the lover. And this is the script of the, only a lover would say the essential nature of beauty. And even the sub part of the title, the tyranny of the aesthetic, this is Jordan's title, by the way. It was a complete, I asked permission to use it as it is. The whole thing is a work of art, and it begs lots of unpacking. The lover archetype, from my perspective, is where you step out of the ego part of the journey, which is never a bad thing. It's just where you're really negotiating self and other, that you're forever trying to navigate this what seems like a divide. The divide is over by this stage of the journey. It's now between you and God, you and your soul. Mm-hmm. I also don't practice any religion. I am a theist, actually. Thanks for giving me that word right now. That's what I would consider myself to be. And where you no longer ask anybody's permission to put your truth and your beauty in the world, you just hit the go button on the camera and you speak and the words are out there. And your life becomes an expression of your own nature as it's coming through you. So do you want to just jump in and talk about the essential nature of beauty?
Oh God, the essential nature of beauty. So I did a project about 8 years ago now. I didn't see it from this quite level of depth, but 8 years ago, I started to notice this anesthetic aesthetic. I put a name to it. I started to notice, wow, and in like every sector of our world, from art to music to architecture to social engineering to education, to, you know, to everything. Beauty is being framed as non-beauty. Beauty is being framed as lifelessness. Beauty is being framed as that which is not sensual or dynamic, that which is like a damp cloth put over as anesthesia. And I don't think I came up with that, but I was trying to define aesthetics. I was trying to find what is beauty, because this is something that's universal. What is aesthetics? And I was like, well, maybe define through the opposite. Oh, what's the opposite of aesthetics? Anesthesia. Holy crap. It's lack of sensation. It's lack of experience. It's not pain. It's not even ugliness. You know, it's nothingness. It's not, you know? And so I was reading this book, which I've been wanting to read for ages, because I traveled to Morocco in the early 2000s, did a semester over there. And Ibn Battuta, you can't see this, but Ibn Battuta.
Yeah, we can see it. That's perfect.
With somebody who was a 13th century, I think like son of a merchant or something like that, from Morocco. And I learned about Ibn Battuta when I was over there. Somebody mentioned Ibn Battuta, and I heard about this book, and I was like, oh God, I got to read that. And I forgot about it. And then I remembered it last year, and I was like, I got to get that book. So I asked my wife for it. She gave it to me for Christmas. So Ibn Battuta was this Moroccan from the 1300s, the 14th century, I guess, and he traveled. He had some money, but he traveled from Morocco. He decided he wanted to travel the world. Got all these camels, got this money, and traveled from Morocco to Egypt, to Syria, to Saudi Arabia, to Yemen, to Saudi Arabia, to China, to India, to sub-Saharan Africa, to Turkey, and back to Morocco. And he had like 20 years of travel or something like that. And he kept journals of his experience. And like primary source history is so important. Because I could read about the travels of Ibn Battuta from any, you know, historian or some talking head who wants to analyze blah, 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 blah. But hearing the words of this guy himself and his experience of the world and the types of observations that he makes and what he appreciates and doesn't appreciate about the humans he's traveling with and who he meets and what he finds commendable and praiseworthy versus condemnable, it really speaks to an aesthetic experience of the world and life. And he gets to this point in his travels. He's a devout Muslim, and he's been through Egypt into Syria. And every time he gets to a city, he's just like, wow, the city has the most beautiful bazaars, and it's the most clean bazaars. Or if it's like a crappily run city that's ugly, he'll really trash on it. He's like, this place is blah, blah, blah. But it's from this aesthetic, godly place where he's got a compass of what's true and what's false and what's beautiful and what's ugly and what's good and what's bad. And it's so refreshing and true and real. There's no question in his mind about how things are. But he finally comes to the city of Mecca. And it's his first time in Mecca. And he gets to the mosque, the great mosque with the Kaaba in it. And he writes this passage, and it is just so right on. And I start this little video with that passage because it stood out to me when I was first trying to study aesthetics. I was reading all of these postmodernist Marxist jerks, you know, who were dissecting beauty and aesthetics from this sick, nihilistic standpoint. And I was seeking their process to understand something that's divine and that I can go outside and channel myself. But I wanted to learn to talk about it. And then I read this passage, and he's talking about how when he first witnesses this mosque and the elation and sublimity that it brings to his heart, the beauty, the architectural beauty of this place of worship, of this place of God, he can do nothing but give thanks to God for planting the seed in his heart that is naturally drawn to the appreciation of an experience of beauty. And he just revels in it for about two paragraphs, blah, 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 blah. And he's like, this is something. I don't know if I can find it real quick. I want to
do it.
How he finishes.
Absolutely.
How
absolutely.
He finishes this. I'm just going to read the first and the last lines, which I have in that video. Of the wondrous doings of God Most High in this is that he's created in the hearts of men with an instinctive desire to seek these sublime sanctuaries and yearning to present themselves at their illustrious sites, and has given the love of them such power over men's hearts that none alights in them but they seize his whole heart, nor quits them but with grief at separation from them, sorrowing at his far journey away from them, filled with longing for them, and purposing to repeat his visitation to them. He's talking about this longing for beauty. And the example he's giving is beautiful places of worship, churches, mosques, the grandiose tile work. He goes into it. And then he says, truly, this is a divine thing and a God-given benefit, a proof uncontaminated by ambiguity, unobscured by dubiety, and inaccessible to deception. He's saying beauty is something that cannot be destroyed or corrupted. It cannot be explained out of. And he says, which is of compelling cogency in the perception of men of understanding and shatters the rationalism of the intellectuals. So he's saying you can't defeat it. This is a divine equation. This mm-hmm. is something that's written into all of us. We know how to experience it. We know how to recognize it when we see it, when we feel it, when we smell it, when we taste it. And he's expressing gratitude for it. And even back in 1326 or 1340s or whenever he wrote that passage, he mm-hmm. said it shatters the rationalism of the intellectuals. So even Ibn Battuta, 700 years ago, had to make that extra little, you know, peak critique to be like, he's making a point. Even back then, the intellectuals were trying to deconstruct things and wrap their heads around it and gain dominion over it. And so as I read that, and then I went and picked up some Theodore Adorno, I was like, good Lord, you know, there's such different, they're antithetical approaches to experiencing something. And the essential nature of it is very important. And it really brought me to this kind of place where I've done a couple of videos about essential things, because I think recognizing something as essential is very important. And I think that when we recognize what is essential and what is not essential as far as human nature, as far as the structure of reality, we can find those are the jugular veins. Those are the jugular veins that the postmodern nihilistic tyrant tend to go for. Mother-child connection, beauty, things like that that are immutable. That we are naturally drawn to. And so the purpose of the video that I did was to speak to the hypocrisy of hypocrisies that I see in the, for one, to speak to the essential nature of beauty and examples that I see of that and one's relation to it. And then to highlight some of the hypocrisies that I see people that abandon the commitment or the understanding, men of understanding, people who abandon their understanding that things like this are essential, are eternal, and are cosmic seeds that are gifts, but rather choose to position them as curses, rather to choose to position them as things that need to be overcome and proven wrong, are acting out of what I describe as a satanic impulse. It's an impulse to assert one's own importance and dominion over reality, over what actually is, and accept it from a place of gratitude and appreciation and love, like Ibn Battuta does. So the way that I see people approaching beauty these days, from art to architecture, to music, to style, to whatever it might be, is very much in a defiant, narcissistic stance against natural aesthetics that I think we can recognize cross-culturally speaking. And again, it's not just about the West or patriarchy, as gender studies would have everybody believe every ounce of reality was created by some elusive, you know, conspiratorial patriarchy. You and I can go to the Sistine Chapel, and be smitten by its beauty, just the same as we can go to the Great Wall or Angkor Wat or the pyramids of Giza or the Sphinx or something like that. It's not a culturally specific thing. It's a human seed. It's something that's been planted in our hearts and we know how to recognize it. And it's not going on very much these days out in the, it's not being honored, I should say. And I think that there's an active rebellion against it. And aesthetics is, rather than being aligned with beauty, is being aligned with anesthesia. And I think that's from a place of egotism and the desire to assert oneself over God.
Wow. So much. You're just nailing it on every level from my perspective. So good. The lover archetype gives way to the hedonist in my system. And so once you've established yourself in your soul's expression, then you inherit the pleasure of life because the beauty and the pleasure make life worth living.
Mm.
Right. Yeah. The toiling and the working and the sweat equity and all that, like there is a certain beauty to that too. You can absolutely find it. I know I actually feel so fortunate in my own work right now that so much of it is so rewarding at that level, exactly as this is. In fact, I was in a terrible mood earlier. Now I feel great.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I was a terrible one, but I do feel great now.
Oh, good. Oh, good. That's great. You know, it's so that what just what you're saying in terms of you can see at every turn that they're removing the aesthetic, and we are drinking by the gallon the anesthetic, and we think that pleasure means the absence of pain, but there's nothing sadder than that, and the depth of it truly is hell where you go to that you cannot, you know, the pain is going to continue to get your attention. It's actually part of the beauty and the fabric of existence that creates that sine wave when you know you put the pain and then the pleasure, and we have those two things to compare. Do you agree? You just wouldn't know what pleasure is if you didn't have the other experience, right?
Yeah, I think that's just the nature of being a sensuous being. Mm-hmm. Sensuousness is sensuousness, and if you try to cut it out, you're trying to cut it out. You know, it's
cut it all.
And it, yeah, mm-hmm.
I think the whole spectrum of being human, exactly. So, yeah, we are being invited to turn into machines, and there's no end of suffering at the level of the soul if you have the goal for freedom and the will to keep your soul intact. And that's what the war is on, ultimately, as far as I'm concerned. This is a spiritual war, and beauty and meaning right on the heels of that are the sad casualties of that war.
Absolutely. Yeah. The scary thing to me, and I mean, it's refreshing to read things like Battuta who recognizes when the technology wasn't even anywhere near what it is today, who recognizes the rationalism of the intellectuals and how these kinds of things shatter it. It's refreshing to me because I'm like, okay, great. People have been dealing with this for a long time, been dealing with groups of individuals who are trying to break down the structure of the divine structure of reality, let's call it. However, my concern today, I will say, you know, I work hard to have faith that God is stronger than Satan, to have faith that divine order is stronger than chaos, to have faith that the light shines in the darkness and the darkness doesn't overcome the light. Mm-hmm. And it's not always easy to have that kind of faith, especially when we're facing the level of technological capacity for technological manipulation that we do see today, you know, to the point where things can be implanted into your physical body and chips and wave manipulation and things like that do make these dystopian prospects seem far more tenable and potentially, you know, likely.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Exactly. Beautiful. I'd just love to ask one more question before we start to close, and also just to acknowledge how many beautiful comments are coming. When I do these interviews, I really like to pay my full attention to you so that I can hear what you're saying and interact in a way, but not to discount the chat will be here for both of us to go through. So I'm looking forward to all of your comments, reading them. Justine, hello. You put a link. Maybe this is the link to Jordan's video. Do you want to just say the name of your channel and how people would reach you and connect with your work?
Well, as far as the channel goes, the name is Poppy Aesthesia. Poppy's what my first daughter called me when she was little, P-A-P-I, and then Aesthesia, A-E-S-T-H-E-S-I-A. Poppy Aesthesia is the name of my channel. And so the founding, you know, the found the common thread I seek or the foundation that I seek is in that seed of aesthesia, you know, and that which brings us into life rather than out of it. That's kind of like my guiding light with the channel. And so you can find that on YouTube. I would like to, you know, get all the videos up elsewhere as well. I have all the videos, so I'm not, you know, if YouTube decides to whatever, destroy my channel, whatever, I'll put them up elsewhere. But that's the only place that they exist right now.
Right?
Yeah, that's okay. It. Yeah. And so, you know, I'd love it if people came and subscribed and shared their comments and things like that and shared other ideas, you know, in the comments as far as links to other, you know, content. And, it, you know, also like I've never done interviews on my channel. And I think it'd be fun to do that kind of thing. So if anybody, you know, else is riffing on some ideas and wants to discuss things or even might have a counterpoint, that would be something that I'd be curious to do. So, you know, people can always comment if they want to get in touch with me. I think my email is accessible if they go to the about part of the channel and they can email me, if they want to, you know, whatever, go to tea or have a conversation offline or have a conversation online or anything like that. As far as the work that I do, because I go off the rails with what I speak about, I try not to associate the organization that I work with it so that I don't get confused as being a spokesperson for them. But if there are any men out there who want to get involved in rites of passage work, they can contact me as well. And I'd be happy to enroll them into that work that I'm doing.
Okay. Fantastic. That's great. And what advice would you give maybe the young king hero, which I consider you to be one? It's amazing. You're just like so out there. There are so many men, young men like you. It's incredibly hopeful for me to have connected with them. Some end up my clients and in just conversations or in my world one way or another. But what advice would you give to them right now, especially given the day and age that we live in, what we're going through, this kind of hell? You know, we need our men strong more than ever. That's my not hidden agenda for doing this show, is to just show people that there are strong men out there who are willing to take a stand and be in their moral ground like this and pursue the truth and put their goodness out into the world. What advice could you share with them at this time?
Well, not to sound like a proselytizer, but I definitely would invite people into leaning into the idea that their soul is eternal. That's important for me in this work. I don't know that I would be able to maintain the level of fortitude. I probably would, even if this was it, even if the physical reality was it, I'd probably still be acting in this way because I see these ways of action and playing out in the physical world in the most beneficent manner. However, I think there's an extra dimension of strength and purpose that comes when I lean into I don't even want to say the idea. For me, it's a reality that it's beyond just this. It's beyond just the social fabric. It's beyond just me as an individual. It's a deeper alignment that goes to the cosmic kind of metaphysical level. So I would invite people to explore that in whatever way works for them, to invite their connection to the divine, to God. And that doesn't need to look any way, but I do make that invitation. And another big one for me is responsibility. I invite men to seek their freedom through the responsibilities that they're taking, and to be good fathers if they're fathers, and to be in their children's lives as much as they can be. That's, you know, and I think that getting involved to speak what's true, to speak what's true. Don't hide it. I mean, not everybody needs to start a YouTube channel. I mean, it's a YouTube channel. There's a million YouTube channels. I'm really glad that I have one. I'm glad that you found me. I'm really glad that we're having this conversation. It's extremely important and cathartic for me. But the advice that I would give wouldn't necessarily be to find a way to speak what you're thinking, even though I think that's important. I think it's important for people to relate to each other And if there's an opportunity to mentor, you know, for a young man, so I'm 35, you know, I'm not that young. But if we're talking about like men my age, I would encourage them to have relationships with younger men and older men, and to mentor boys, to be a mentor in a boy's life, whether that's a son of a friend of yours or a nephew or something like that, to start showing up physically for somebody, and modeling for them these strengths and speaking truth in front of them. Because if all they have is gender studies at public school and whatever they're watching on the internet, there's a lot of crazy directions that they can go, and it's a whirlwind, and they're getting all kind of messaging sent to them. So I think being showing up for kids is very important, and I think that regardless of whether or not you're a parent, it creates purpose, and it's hard. I mean, it's hard to build those relationships, but I really advocate for boots on the ground, you know, physical relationship of some kind. When I say physical, I just mean being in the presence of somebody, like interacting, you know, and mentorship. That's finding purpose and finding your strength through that, because that's really for me, what parenthood is, what distinguished me to myself as a man. That was the big initiation for me. And then going the extra step of reaching back and mentoring boys who were not my children initiated me further into manhood. And I think it's through those cycles of relationships that define us for the place that we are in our life, and fully solidify ourselves and make it real and make it clear just what responsibility we have. I mean, we have to take it if we're gonna have the responsibility. Otherwise, it's just an idea.
You don't get to keep what you have unless you give it away.
You don't know what you have?
You don't get to keep it.
You don't get to keep it unless you give it away. Oh, that's nice. Okay. Yeah. I like that.
That's the hero's journey. We could just slay our demons and go and lay on the beach. Perfect. But it doesn't work that way.
Well, let's encapsulate my long-winded thing to that. And just, we'll tell, that's the advice. That's the appropriate advice for the young man. That's beautiful.
It's good teamwork. I love it. So what do you guys think? This has been incredibly enlightening and beautiful and, you know, so powerful. It's a comfort to find a voice like yours out in the wild. So thanks to Steve Mercer. I guess he couldn't make it live here, but I'm sure he'll be checking this out. You know, if you guys have any comments, just what you've enjoyed about this interview, then feel free to drop in the comments right now or in the comments below the video. Feel free to visit me at bethmartins.com if you haven't already signed up to get a reading of your King Hero's Journey archetype that reads not who you are, but where you are on this path of purpose, and certainly to be valued for it as well. So then I think for today, we will call it a day. Thank you so much for joining me. It's been an immense pleasure, Jordan.
Same here, Beth. Thanks so much.
Okay. All right, everybody. Here we go. Excellent conversation from Flat Plain, Oregon. Big love to all. Nice. Spot on, mate. Getting some good comments here. Thank you very much. All right, everyone. Take care. Have a beautiful rest of your day. And do join us Friday morning, the 12th, with Ole Demigard, who's going to be here in the house. And we're going to be talking about truth or bust, what that means to literally not have any standard other than truth. And you're not going to bow down or give in to your fears for any reason, and also talking about some of the roadkill that can come. I've said that very unaffectionately, but it's the truth of it. So we're going to talk about it and how to get past it. So please join us. I think I will be ready for a call-in at that point, so you'll be able to actually call and ask questions, which will be really fun and exciting as well. Thank you, everyone. I really appreciate your presence. And thank you once again, Jordan. Bye for now.